It offered him a chance to walk in the footsteps not only of his own father, but also of the father of the country, with a chance for military glory rivaling even Washington's. In the three tremulous hours that they spoke, of which no record exists, Lee not only declined, surely the most painful decision of his life, but he also resigned his commission from the army. However much this son of an ardent Federalist longed for compromise to save the Union, in the end, the permanency of birth and blood won out. "I cannot raise my hand against my birthplace, my home, my children," he told a friend sadly. And he explained, "Save in defense of my native state, I never desire again to draw my sword." But draw his sword he would. 5 days later, Lee accepted an appointment as Commander-in-Chief of Virginia's military forces. 3 weeks after that, he was made a Brigadier General in the Confederate Army. He did it for honor, but with no illusions and the heaviest of hearts. "I foresee that the country will have to pass through a terrible ordeal," he warned soberly. But in the end, he never openly regretted his decision or its consequences. "I did only what duty demanded, and if it were to be done over again, I should act in precisely the same manner." Would Lee be equal to the task? He was one of the best-known and most watched men of his era. Yet as the diarist, Mary Chestnut, who watched him more closely than most, once asked, "Can anybody say they know the general?" And she was surely right. For a man of such immense discipline, he was filled with paradoxes. All his life he had stubbornly adhered to the military chain of command, even when it galled him, except once, when he chose Virginia and the Confederacy over the Union. Austere, ascetic, devoted, he neither drank nor swore nor smoked, yet he delighted in such pleasures as music, dancing, and food, especially fried chicken. Forever faithful to his wife, he was a constant flirt with other women and maintained a sensuous and lifelong correspondence with several of them. Never self-righteous, he was a pious man, praying regularly and long. During the war, he resorted to firing squads to cut down on desertions. His father was more brutal, he had once beheaded a man, but he also freely pardoned guilty men. And despite his legendary self-control, his foul moods and his temper were equally well known. Finally, as much as any other general, including Grant, including Sherman, including Stonewall Jackson, and certainly including his hero George Washington, Lee had a true killer instinct. In battle, his audacity, his aggressiveness, his boldness, his intuition were second to none. Yet at the same time, there was a surprising and decidedly unusual feminine side to him, a sweetness, a benignity, a tenderness unthinkable in other great fighting men. Once, during the Petersburg siege, one of Richmond's citizens sent him a peach, the first he had seen since 1862. He had it hand-carried to his wife. Physically, he was impressive, and again paradoxical. Nearly 6 feet tall, with a powerful, imposing frame and a striking barrel chest, he nonetheless radiated beauty and grace, accentuated by his unexpectedly tiny feet, 4C, and a beautifully shaped mouth. His eyes could be large, sad, and brooding. At the same time, when he was angered, his cold stare was unforgettable. Women swooned over him. Whenever he visited a barber, they invariably lined up for strands of his gray hair. In 1863, one Union girl watching Lee pass her Pennsylvania home near Gettysburg cried out, "Oh, I wish he were ours." Similarly, when he was a much younger man, his fellow cadets at West Point had called him the Marble Model, and by his mid-50s, when his head was at first tinged with gray, then white, he acquired the aura of a Homeric patriarch. Dignified, humble, gentle, he invariably saved the best not for himself, but for the heat of battle, and, most of all, for his men. And in turn, they idolized him. When he rode among them, they did not whoop or cheer, but rather stood quietly, in awe, removing their hats reverently. "I've heard of God," one Southerner remarked, "but I've seen General Lee." Even Stonewall Jackson, who generally rested his confidence only in the Lord, gave him unshakable support. So great is my confidence in General Lee that I am willing to follow him blindfolded. Still, Lee struck some of his aides as rigid, inflexible, and, most of all, icy and aloof. But he also earned their admiration. "Ah," one of his adjutants once rumbled, "but he is a queer old genius." His men called him affectionately Uncle Robert, or Mars Robert, or Granny Lee, or the King of Spades, and for those who knew him well, Bobby Lee. Bobby Lee never wrote his memoirs, and rarely did he confide in others, even in his many letters. What mark he left of himself was largely on the battlefield. And as a military man, Lee was largely without peer. His genius, whether on offense or defense, was always the same, somehow turning adversity to his advantage. As the war ground on, Lee increasingly lacked troops, lacked resources, and lacked resourceful subordinates. But against enormous odds, he won great battles, halting McClellan's threat to Richmond, routing Pope at Second Manassas, destroying Burnside at Fredericksburg, and pummeling Hooker at Chancellorsville. He was at once a consummate military realist, coolly gauging his odds before going into battle. At the same time, he took chances as did no one else, gambling, probably rightly, that the South had few other alternatives. This, of course, led him to such maddening, even suicidal, escapades as taking on an army twice his size and actually dividing his own forces and then dividing them again, before concentrating his columns as he did at Chancellorsville. It was a stunning victory. Or using the mountains as cover while again halving his army and thoroughly baffling the enemy, as he did at Second Manassas, achieving another decisive victory. It also led to his boldest risk of all, his desire to fight one great and grand climactic battle on northern soil, which produced the disappointment at Antietam, the bloodiest day in American history, and culminated in an even greater disappointment, Gettysburg. Was Lee a born warrior? It is certain that his faith in gallantry ran deep. It is not without significance that he reconstructed the family coat of arms and believed that the family was descended from the legendary Scottish hero, Robert the Bruce. Nor is it without significance that at West Point, he assiduously studied the campaigns of Napoleon in his spare time, and he was most certainly at home with the fanfare of war, the striking of the colors, the rhythmic beat of the drums, the peal of the bugles, the raising of arms, the fixing of bayonets, the turning of the flank. Lee loved war as a profession, accepting bloodshed and destruction with an alacrity that civilians, and even many generals, would find hard to fathom. But it is not clear that he loved war itself. What he cherished was duty. Listen to his words. "It is well that war is so terrible," he once said, after not a defeat but a victory, "or we should grow too fond of it." And, "What a cruel thing is war, to separate and destroy families and friends, to fill our hearts with hatred instead of love for our neighbors, and to devastate the fair face of this beautiful world." And, "My heart bled for the inhabitants, the women and children." Not a Grant, and most certainly not a Sheridan, could have ever uttered those words, but they come naturally from Lee. Indeed, where a Grant or a Sherman or a Stonewall Jackson could leave a swath of destruction in his wake without openly shedding a tear, Lee never lost sight of the fact that it was a multitude of fellow human beings who were being destroyed. He never became detached toward death, and he could openly weep at the loss of one of his own men, as he did when A.P. Hill died. Indeed, while he was not an overly philosophical man, being a fighter rather than a talker, he was often astonishingly reflective, even eloquent, after the death of one of his own. "The loss of our gallant men causes me to weep tears of blood and wish I never heard the sound of a gun again." But one should never mistake this as a sign of vulnerability. As a soldier and a commander, Lee relentlessly went for the enemy's jugular. In truth, his face never brightened more than at the prospect of military success. Where other Confederate generals may have felt urgency or even panic in the swirl of conflict and the prospect of defeat, Lee felt challenged. Where, after setbacks, other commanders would have sunk into gloom, Lee tightly fixed his jaw and resolved never to quit. Throughout the war, he was beset by physical problems, sore throats, heavy colds, coughs, fever, elevated pulse, chest pain, back pain, arm pain, angina pectoris, lumbago, sciatica, extreme diarrhea, 2 sprained hands and broken bones in one of them, leaving him unable to ride for a month, and predictably exhaustion. He was also afflicted by constant anxiety, day and night, and sorrow. It is wearing me away. But he never allowed any of it to slow him down or delay his campaigns. Always he soldiered on. With greater frequency, he insisted on riding out with his men, or leading them in a charge, flirting nearly each time with death. And as the war progressed, he increasingly salted his speech with the language of military offense, railed against not attacking, "We cannot be idle," and spoke fervently about a battle of annihilation that would erode Union morale once and for all. But as great a fighting man as Lee was, he had his flaws, with many of his virtues as a man becoming vices for a commander. As a general, he was not stern enough with his own men, unlike a Stonewall Jackson who countenanced no deviation, or a U.S. Grant, whose orders were given as absolutes. Nor was he cruel enough. In contrast to a Sherman or a Sheridan, he refused to burn or plunder enemy property, or engage in selective assassination, declaring it unchristian and atrocious, even though the South could have greatly benefited from such tactics. For all his strategic genius and killer instinct, Lee ultimately led not by fear or fiat, but example. Thus, he found it difficult to dismiss incompetent officers, or to settle disputes over authority, or to discipline men who fell out of line. Equally, he shrank from confrontation with his own subordinates, guiding them less by outright command than by suggestion, which, of course, proved fatal at Gettysburg. And he was never much of a hater. Like Lincoln, more often than not, he called the other side "those people," rather than blindly labeling them the enemy. When his house on the Pamunkey River was burned to the ground and later his mansion at Arlington gutted, even the priceless Washington relics were stolen, he never evinced any bitterness toward the Yankees, still alluding to many of his former friends and companions in the kindest terms. In 1865, when the grounds at Arlington were turned into a Union cemetery, perhaps the greatest insult of all, to him as well as to his family name, he issued not one word of protest, not one rebuke, not one bitter rejoinder. Yet lying beneath all the reserve and dignity and nobility, Lee was a strikingly emotional man. He was fiery, fiercely competitive, at times impulsive, quietly ardent, and certainly passionate. But like his idol George Washington, he carefully controlled these emotions. Still, this passion was always there, just beneath the surface. You could see it in everything he did, in his subtle change of moods, the quick flashes of anger, the occasional hard stare of disapproval, and the sudden twinkle of his eye when pleased. You could see it in his little gestures of affection for his wife and his loved ones, and you could see it in the tears he openly shed at the loss of his comrades. But most of all, you could see it in his face once the battle began anew. Lee fought to win as no one else did. He sought victory until events wrenched it from him. Robert E. Lee, son of Light Horse Harry Lee, child of Stratford, husband of Mary Custis, scion of the First Family, and General-in-Chief of the Confederate Armies, was not about to let destiny slip through his fingers. U.S. Grant and the Union, of course, learned this the hard way in 1864 at a place called the Wilderness. By far the 6 bloodiest weeks of the war, this campaign across a 100-mile crescent was the crucial prelude to the Petersburg siege. And equally, it was the crucial backdrop to the Lee Grant cat-and-mouse chase commencing in the first days of April 1865. It was in the early spring of 1864 that Grant had worked out a coordinated plan for the simultaneous destruction of the Confederate Army, massing as much force in as many locations as possible. Sherman would strike out for Chattanooga and make a drive for Atlanta, and, as Grant instructed George Gordon Meade, who was to lead the Army of the Potomac, "Wherever Lee goes, you will go also. But this was typical understatement, for Grant himself would go there too, to shadowbox, to fight, and, he hoped, to personally crush Robert E. Lee. He earnestly believed that the North could win the war in a matter of months, a month or two, to be exact. As Grant assembled his hulk of a war machine over 8 weeks, outfitted and armed it, and sent it thumping toward his foe, Lee lay in wait in the steaming green tangle of the wilderness. There, Grant enjoyed a 2-to-1 advantage in troops, 115,000 contesting 64,000. But Lee knew the terrain. And if Grant wanted to force Lee into a showdown out in the open, Lee, too, was thinking offensively. His ally here would be the smoke-filled woods where he would seek to ensnare Grant, just as he had done to Hooker at the Battle of Chancellorsville, fought some 5 miles from this very spot just a year before. It would be a defender's dream, one in which he hoped to turn Grant's drive into a welter of slaughter. On May 5, the first hostilities began, along the same fords, the same somber gloom, the same swamp and swale that also told of the savagery of Chancellorsville. Here, shreds of flesh, it was human tissue, and shards of blackened bone now rose from half-finished graves. Birds nested in hollow sockets of weathered skulls that bore silent witness to the previous year's fighting, and horses dug uneasily at decayed legs and arms, still swathed in remnants of enemy clothing. Even the low shrubs seemed rotten with bloodstains. The wilderness began, as did so many other fateful battles, with a chance encounter. But within hours, this battle became something radically different. Under the dense cover of the woods, a savage fighting ruled. Soldiers could rarely see the enemy through the twisted expanse of scrub oak and pines. They fired blindly into the smoke and murk, shooting at adversaries and allies alike. By noon, the combat had descended into sheer chaos. Commands separated and scattered, mistakes went unexploited, and the geometry of conflict was maddening. Opposing pockets of men, lost or confused or confounded, were tangled along all points of the compass, and soon the compass was the only instrument by which commanders could find their regiments. Darker than the blackest night, beneath the canopy of smoke and trees without even stars to steer by, the wilderness was now plunged into what one veteran described as the battle of the invisibles with invisibles. Explained another soldier, it was a blind and bloody hunt to the death, in bewildering thickets rather than a battle. As the fighting raged throughout the afternoon, men crawled feverishly on their bellies, groping their way forward as bullets sliced through the air like 1,000 small scythes. Then, suddenly, exploding rounds of shells set the underbrush on fire, and, soon, the crackle of flames intermingled with the wild screams of men and animals roasting alive. But the Federals kept coming, attacking and attacking, in wave after wave, never surrendering the advantage and never once allowing Lee a chance to maneuver. The fighting seesawed back and forth. By nightfall, a tenuous stalemate reigned, and men lay exhausted, resting fitfully on their muskets, mindful that their closest neighbor, a biscuit's toss away, might be the enemy. After 8 p.m., except for random, anxious gunfire and the moans of the near dead and dying, it grew strangely quiet. But the lull was only momentary. The Federals had secured a crucial position for attacking Lee's right. Now they meant to make something of it. Before dawn came, Grant ordered the assault. Lee, too, had planned a dawn assault, but Grant beat him to the punch. In darkness, the hard-fighting Yankees drove the rebels almost a mile through the woods, and then burst right through the Confederate center, converging on a small clearing where Lee had his headquarters. As the peril grew, a red-faced and agitated Lee spurred his horse forward into the confused mass, even as Federals advanced on him, only 200 yards away. In a sense, for Lee this was lunacy. A year before, He had lost his most valued general, Stonewall Jackson, to friendly fire, just 3 miles away in the same tangled vine and underbrush. This very morning, another of his most vaunted generals, James Longstreet, would be badly wounded by rebel guns, shot through the throat and shoulder by his own pickets. But as a swirl of smoke suddenly surrounded him, Lee was oblivious. When the smoke cleared, Lee eyed a score of ragged soldiers dashing forward. They were Texans. "Attention, Texas Brigade!" the Confederate General John Gregg shouted. "The eyes of General Lee are upon you." One of those Texans recalled, "Scarcely had we moved a step when General Lee, in front of the whole command, raised himself in the stirrups, uncovered his gray hairs, and with an earnest voice exclaimed, 'Texans, always move them!' The four words filled the air like a bugle call. Glimpsing Lee, the men unleashed a wild cheer, and the Texans began to fight back stubbornly. 'I would charge hell itself for that old man,' cried one soldier, tears coursing down his cheeks before he plunged into battle. And charge they did. Of the 673 Texans who went forward, only 223 survived. Moreover, to the horror of the men, Lee stubbornly seemed intent on charging with them. 'Go back, General Lee! Go back!' shouted the Texans as they swept toward the Yankees. Lee ignored them and continued forward, as many balls and bullets began to rake the brigade. 'We won't go on unless you go back,' they cried. Lee continued onward. 'Lee to the rear,' they shouted. 'Lee to the rear.' Finally, Lee did fall back, and the Confederates halted the Union advance. By day's end, spurred on by Lee, the Confederates and not the Union had prevailed, smashing Grant's right, seizing two generals and 600 prisoners, and coming close to cutting off the Union supply line. When night fell, the killing and dying continued. Brush fires raged through the wilderness, consuming some 200 wounded men alive. It was like a scene from the depths of Dante. Screams echoed through the forest, the wind screeched through the tops of flaming pines, and the gamey scent of charred flesh filled the air. One officer described that stretch of woods as an unutterable horror. But for Grant, it was more than that. He had lost an astonishing 17,500 men in these 2 days alone. Late that evening, as men roasted and writhed and died unseen, the Union general hunched his shoulders, crawled into his tent, threw himself face down on his cot, and wept. Other times, after being thrashed by Lee, previous Union commanders had invariably stuck their tail between their legs, withdrawn, and retreated. But not Grant, not even as panic spread through his own headquarters. "Whatever happens," he assured Lincoln, "we will not retreat." He didn't. Grant kept coming. In the ensuing days, the shadow boxing continued. At Spotsylvania, a dozen miles away, Lee's men quickly constructed an elaborate network of trenches, breastworks, artillery emplacements, traverses, and abatis to entangle attackers, the strongest such fieldworks thus far. Grant was left with two options: flank the defenses or blast through them. He tried both. Both failed. Yet Grant felt that a spot the men called the Mule Shoe could be penetrated with a larger force, splitting the weak seam of Lee's army in two. "A brigade today," Grant boomed confidently, "we'll try a corps tomorrow." At dawn, after a chill, ill-tempered rain had fallen, Grant hurled a full 20,000 men forward across a mile-wide front. The screaming bluecoats swarmed through the mist and drizzle in a crowded, elbow-to-elbow mass and successfully burst through the Confederate trenches. The rebels quickly fell back, and the Union men occupied their log breastworks. For Lee, it looked like a debacle. And farther down along the rebel line, another crisis was brewing. Here, the fighting turned vicious, producing some of the most frightful combat ever fought on American soil. Along a few hundred yards of muddy trenches, the men slugged it out for hours in the endless rain. In an often frenzied hand-to-hand contest, skulls were smashed with club muskets. Soldiers were slashed by bayonets thrust between the breastwork logs. Arms and faces were cut to pieces, and the wounded were entombed alive by slabs of newly dead bodies sinking down upon them. Blue and gray fired muskets muzzle to muzzle, and, when there were no longer any weapons, they feebly struck at each other with little more than battle flags. Joined in a grisly ballet of death, they hurled their empty guns like spears, reached backward for freshly loaded weapons, and continued firing until gunned down or bayoneted themselves. As one man fell, like Medusa's locks, another quickly sprang forward to take his place. In previous battles, hand-to-hand combat like this had usually dissolved quickly, with one side collapsing and retreating. But today, both lines held. Soldiers stayed and stood their ground. The results were ghastly. Union flags intermingled with Confederate flags, Northern limbs with Southern limbs. Blood ran as thick and furious as the rain, turning the muddy trench floors red. And on this muck, the dead and wounded were crushed by the next wave of fighting men, surging forward, jabbing this way and that. The bullets sprayed with such ferocity that during one assault, a thick oak tree behind Southern lines was cut down by a barrage of mini-balls. This was, in historian James McPherson's words, an atavistic territorial battle that continued from early morning through the afternoon, into the night, for a full 18 hours, in the cold, damp rain. It was called Bloody Angle. Meanwhile, back at the Mule Shoe, Lee's situation worsened. Grant's men had borne straight down and broken it, splitting the Confederate army in two. This was now a crisis of unconscionable proportions, and, as he had done 6 days earlier in the wilderness, Lee personally started to lead his reserve divisions in a counterattack. Again the soldiers, this time Georgians, Virginians, and Carolinians, let out a thundering shout, "General Lee to the rear! General Lee to the rear!" One of Lee's most trusted lieutenants, General John Gordon, a rising brigadier from Georgia, called out, asking the men if they would fail Lee. "No, no, no," they roared back. "We'll not fail him." Turning back to Lee, Gordon himself shouted, "You must go to the rear." Lee would not. Only when the troops surged around him, turned his horse, and pressed him back, did the rebel commander relent. But, galvanized by the general's presence, Lee's men rolled forward, and, by nightfall, the Confederate position was out of danger. Once again, they had repulsed Grant. By the next morning, an eerie pall hung over the battlefield. Around Bloody Angle, 11,000 casualties lay dead and dying. All told, the butcher's bill for Spotsylvania was 18,000 casualties for Grant, between 9,000 and 10,000 for Lee. From May 5 to 12, the Army of the Potomac had lost a staggering 32,000, a total greater than all the Union armies combined in any previous week of the war. But still they came at each other. The armies continued to fight for several more days at Spotsylvania, and each time Lee countered Grant's moves. After 6 days, Grant had gained no appreciable ground. He had only added 3,000 more Union casualties. For Grant, the calculations were as simple as they were numbing. He had desperately wanted to lure Lee out into the open, where Union superiority in numbers and firepower could cripple him. But calculations were one thing, execution was another. And thus far, Lee had more than skillfully matched Grant at every move. Back in the North, a pall of gloom settled over the Union psyche. Grant was denounced as a butcher. Northern morale sharply plummeted. The peace movement gained steam, and Northern Democrats glumly proclaimed that patriotism has played out and derided Grant as little more than a bullheaded Suvorov. Still, Grant was relentless. "I propose to fight it out on this line," he memorably declared in one dispatch, "if it takes all summer." Now, as summer approached, Grant's words seemed strangely prophetic. The two armies were locked in a sprint toward a juncture named Cold Harbor, near the Chickahominy River. As before, Lee arrived first and ordered his men to prepare for the blistering attack that he thought would soon come. But while Lee's men dug in, another disconsolate reality settled over the battlefield. The two sides were exhausted. There had been no respite from the fighting, marching, digging, and planning. There had been no rest. After other major battles, one side would invariably retreat beyond the nearest river, giving both a reprieve from the combat. But not this time. Union Captain Oliver Wendell Holmes observed, "Many a man has gone crazy since this campaign began from the terrible pressure on mind and body." He did not exaggerate. Two of Lee's commanders suffered brief breakdowns. Lee himself fell sick for a week. Grant's losses, which virtually outnumbered the strength of Lee's entire army, had left his own men demoralized. And there was talk. Even some of Grant's staff began to grumble about the terrible toll of this dismal campaign. Yet Grant remained not just confident, but almost strangely invincible. "Lee's army is really whipped," he wrote back to Washington. "The prisoners we now take show it, and the action of his army shows it unmistakably. Our men feel they have gained the morale over the enemy and attack with confidence." Armed as he was, he could not fail. Wasting no time, Grant ordered an assault to commence at dawn on June 3. It would take place a mere 9.5 miles from Richmond. But if the Union general thought his troops were invincible, they felt anything but. Grant had badly mistaken the severity of the beating that Lee had imposed upon them over the last 4 weeks. They had seen Lee in action before, and they knew what he was still capable of. As they settled down on the night of the 2nd, hundreds quietly pinned slips of paper with their names and addresses to their uniforms so that their bodies could be identified after the battle. The bugles blew at 4:30 a.m. the next day, and 60,000 Union men rose up. In the dim, gray light, the rebels were waiting. When the word "fire" was uttered, the ground itself began to seethe. Along a 7-mile front, row upon row of blue uniforms came forward. From their trenches, the Confederates greeted the dense mass of attackers with a coordinated round of firepower. The Federals kept charging. The very volume of sound itself seemed unprecedented, combining the fury of the Wilderness musketry with the thunders of the Gettysburg artillery superadded, in the words of one soldier. For Grant, it was an unmitigated bloodbath. Union men fell like dominoes, and Grant suffered some 7,000 casualties that day, most of them in the first 8 minutes of battle alone. The battle's horror was compounded by its astonishing speed. Across some 5 acres, the dead and wounded now lay thickly arranged in tidy little pyramids spread along the Confederate front. Then, by early afternoon, the ear-splitting roar ended. There was only silence, and Grant privately admitted defeat. When talk began of mounting another assault, even his officers would have no more of it. "I will not take my regiment in another such charge," a Union officer protested, "if Jesus Christ should order it." The Battle of Cold Harbor soon became a sullen test of wills between Lee and Grant. For 3 days and nights in this maze of swamps, streams, and hills, the two badly bruised armies glared angrily at each other. An easy stone's throw away, neither commander was willing to tacitly concede defeat by asking for a truce to collect the wounded or bury the dead. As the sun beat down mercilessly, corpses exploded in the heat, and an unendurable stench hung over the battlefield. Men were forced to put makeshift masks over their faces to ward off the stifling smell. Some stuffed green leaves up their nostrils. Grant sent 2 letters asking that unarmed litter bearers from both sides be allowed to collect the casualties. Each time, Lee insisted upon a flag of truce. Meanwhile, the cries and moans of the men grew weaker and fewer and more desperate, even as sharpshooters from both sides took deadly aim and fired at their hapless targets. Eventually, on the evening of June 7, Grant relented, tersely writing to Lee, "The knowledge that wounded men are now suffering from want of attention compels me to ask a suspension of hostilities for sufficient time to collect them." Having won not just the battle but the test of wills, Lee now agreed. When Union litter bearers made it onto the field, of the thousands of blue-coated troops they found, only two were still alive. In the 30 days since Grant had first fired upon Lee in the wilderness, his Army of the Potomac had lost 50,000 men. That same army had lost only twice that, 100,000, in all the previous 3 years of war. A good many of his finest and bravest had fallen. Far many more, another 100,000 alone in just that year, had refused to reenlist. Lincoln, stunned, soon pronounced that the heavens are hung in black. Across the North, Grant's critics only raised their voices further and included the First Lady. "Grant is a butcher and not fit to be at the head of an army," Mary Lincoln protested. "He loses two men to the enemy's one. He has no management, no regard for life." Added one Union man, "We were all quick to criticize McClellan's fear of the Army of Northern Virginia, but anyone that has seen that army fight and march would, were he wise, proceed with caution and wariness, knowing full well that defeat by such an enemy might mean destruction." Said another critic, "It is foolish and wanton slaughter." And even a gloomy Lincoln asked, "Why do we suffer reverse after reverse?" There was, of course, a haunting irony here. While it was Grant himself who had bellowed to his men on the second night in the wilderness, "Oh, I am heartily tired of hearing about what Lee's going to do. Some of you always seem to think he is suddenly going to turn a double somersault and land in our rear and on both of our flanks at the same time. Try to think what we are going to do ourselves, instead of what Lee is going to do." It was now Grant who had been taught the lesson. He would never be so bold or foolish as to underestimate Lee and his men again. As one of his top generals, George Meade, observed pointedly, "I think Grant has had his eyes opened." But Grant refused to stand idly by, nor did he make the traditional river retreat to rest. After Cold Harbor, under the evening shroud, Grant disengaged his army, led his men out of the fortifications, cleared the Chickahominy, leaned toward Richmond, steered left, and then marched swiftly to cross the James. There the Union army went, 35 miles of wagons and artillery, 4,000 cavalry, 3,500 head of cattle, and 60,000 infantrymen, marching warily over the 2,100-foot-wide river. It took 4 days for the last man to reach the other side. In the Chronicle of Modern Warfare, it was certainly an awesome sight, but more than that, it was a stunning change in plans. Lincoln thought so too, telegraphing Grant, "I begin to see it. You will succeed. God bless you, A. Lincoln." Grant's new prize was to be Petersburg, a key communication center, and to its north, Richmond, the Confederate capital and the promised land. And, when he could eventually force Lee out into the open, the Army of Northern Virginia itself. This time, however, his plan was more cautious. He would smother the famed mobility of Lee's army by settling down, if necessary, into precisely what Lee wanted to avoid, a dreadful siege. Some 9 months later, long after the summer had come and gone, the war was still raging, and the siege was still in place. But on April 1, 1865, the day that the Battle of Five Forks began, a now confident Grant, like Lincoln, nonetheless knew better than to underestimate his vaunted foe and the raggedy but hardy veterans that he still faced. Never again would there be a Cold Harbor or a wilderness. Never again would he speculate that Lee was beaten. And here, perhaps at last, Grant had something in common with his wily and ruthless foe. As Lee's men hurled themselves forward at Five Forks, sounding the shrill yip-yip of the rebel yell, Lee was equally resolute that he would not be beaten either. But on April 1, by 7 o'clock that evening, amid the budding trees and blooming daffodils, Five Forks was turning into Lee's first disaster since the campaign had commenced in the wilderness. At long last, a coordinated assault by the Federals had worked. They had not only crumpled Lee's right flank and seized the Five Forks area, but they had almost encircled Petersburg south of the Appomattox River. Of even greater consequence was the fearful toll that the fighting of March 25 and April 1 had taken on Lee's army. He had now lost a solid fourth of his men. For his part, Grant sensed opportunity. When he received news of Sheridan's victory, he bluntly announced, "All right," then ordered a frontal assault. It opened just after midnight on April 2nd, with a massive bombardment, hundreds of guns shelling the rebel trenches. Then, in a thickening fog, the infantry attack began at 4:45 a.m., all along the Petersburg lines. It was the most massive attack since the start of the siege. It would unleash 18 hours of continuous fighting. As Grant's army prepared to approach, Lee was in his headquarters conferring with two of his closest lieutenants, Generals Longstreet and A.P. Hill. His demeanor was calm, but not so his body. He felt unwell, exhausted, and he had barely slept. It was 4 a.m. Abruptly, his door sprang open. An aide rushed in, shouting that the road outside was filled with wagons and teamsters. Lee quickly wrapped a dressing gown around himself and moved to the front door. Peering through the dim light into the darkness and the gathering mist, he could make out only hazy distant objects, silhouettes of skirmishers visible to the southwest. Were they retreating Confederates or advancing bluecoats? It was impossible to tell. Lee ordered a courier out, but it was General A.P. Hill himself who ran to his horse and rode away at a gallop. Pausing momentarily, Lee hastily munched on a biscuit, probably his only meal for the day, and then hurried to dress himself. Finally, in the slow growing light, he could make out the color of the men's uniforms. Blue. They were coming, and coming fast. And his headquarters, Turnbull House, was directly in the line of the Federal advance. Lee raced to the saddle as the steady murmur of guns rolled up toward the house from both the south and the east. He was still surveying his forces below when a small group of horsemen approached. One was bearing Hill's horse. The general had ridden straight into Federal stragglers and had been shot dead, right through the heart. "He is at rest now," Lee pronounced hoarsely, his eyes welling with tears, "and we who are left are the ones to suffer." As the sun rose, however, Turnbull House held. For now, Lee's own situation was secure, but while the telegraph chattered with urgent dispatches to John Breckinridge, to Jefferson Davis, to General Richard Ewell, even that was about to change. While Lee dictated a fateful message to the Secretary of War, "I advise that all preparation be made for leaving Richmond tonight. I will advise you later, according to the circumstances." Federal shells came lobbing into the grounds around Turnbull House. Moving outside, Lee was still dictating another dispatch when his headquarters received a direct hit. Dust and splinters flew through the roof. Everything was covered with debris, and a fire began to roar inside. The telegraph was hurriedly dismantled. Lee's immediate concern, however, was not Federal gunners, but murderous Federal troops themselves, three brigades worth now charging up the hill. Ordering six cannons to be deployed in the house's garden, he immediately assumed control, personally issuing the command to fire. Loaded and ready, rebel batteries held back the first push forward, and then a second. But eventually, Lee could no longer repulse the advancing invaders. There were far too many of them. Experience dictated a quick withdrawal, lest his own party be cut off. Yet even now, Lee himself was the last man to leave the guns. Mounting Traveler, he dashed away at a gallop, while behind him, Turnbull House was feverishly burning to the ground. "This is bad business," Lee muttered acidly, making his way toward the inner fortifications of Petersburg. And the Union push was relentless. A fresh shell struck perilously close, barely missing the general and killing a nearby horse. As the ground shuddered, Lee flashed a cold stare in the direction of the bestial corpse now splayed below his feet. Then he turned eastward and rode off. His determination now, or rather his hope, was that the city's inner defenses would hold until evening, when, under the cover of darkness, his army could more easily slip away. But by the afternoon, even that goal was in peril. Sheridan had seized the last railroad in Petersburg, and the Blue Infantry had smashed through Confederate lines southwest of the city. The rebels fought desperately with their muskets and, when ammunition ran out, with their bayonets as they slowly fell back. Soon, Lee was somberly informed that there were not enough men to reinforce his troops at vital Forts Baldwin and Gregg. His ensuing instructions were as stark as they were simple. The soldiers must fight it out where they were. They did. As old men and shoeless boys as young as 14 stubbornly sought to hold the lines for Lee, "Surrender," the Federals called. "We'll see you in hell first," came the Confederate reply. He and his staff finalized the plans for retreat. The one stumbling block seemed to be the Confederate government in Richmond. Late that afternoon, Lee received Davis's brooding reply, saying that to move tonight will involve the loss of many valuables, both for want of time to pack and of transportation. Reading this, the general's much-vaunted discipline cracked. He abruptly tore the paper to shreds, saying hotly that he was sure he had given Davis sufficient notice, and sent a testy response to Richmond. "Your telegram received. I think it is absolutely necessary that we should abandon our position tonight." And then he added, "I have given all necessary orders on the subject of the troops, and the operation, though difficult, I hope will be performed successfully." Lee's new destination lay to the west, a hard 40-mile march away. It was called Amelia Courthouse, and here, in an extraordinary cataract of events, a simple bit of fate would unalterably change history, although neither Lee nor Grant knew it yet. Aboard the River Queen, after a diet of sleepless nights, Abraham Lincoln was hovering between anxiety and exhilaration. Inside his cabin, as guns boomed in the distance, he stood hunched over his table spread with huge military maps, moving red and black pins around to follow the rapidly changing battle. Already, after Five Forks, he had been presented with some captured Confederate flags. "Here is something material," he rejoiced, "something I can see, feel, and understand. This means victory. This is victory." Even Grant, too, had begun to believe. From inside the rebel fortifications, he exulted in his current triumph over Robert E. Lee, quietly writing to his wife that this was one of the greatest victories of the war. But the North's long-awaited victory was nonetheless marred. Even as Richmond and Petersburg stood poised to fall, the ultimate prize evaded Grant. Under the cover of darkness, Lee had once again escaped, stealthily crossing the Appomattox River and forging westward. For respite, for Johnston, for food, and then for more fight. It was now a race. April 2, 1865 began in Richmond with the steady tolling of bells that awoke a slumbering city. It was Communion Sunday. Most Richmonders arose as usual, unaware of the dire situation unfolding below the James. They were soon to be enlightened. For weeks now, in the early morning quiet, every sound had held a poignant meaning. The rumbling of wagons indicated heavy loads being hauled to the Danville rail line. The roll of cannons meant another skirmish by Petersburg. The anxious tread of feet signified faithful soldiers, young boys as well as older men, heading to man the breastworks around Richmond. Not a day went by in which the danger signals didn't flare. Not a night passed in which disaster didn't stalk the town. But during these bleak moments, Richmonders coped. Hope and religious ardor, and the understandable unwillingness to face disaster, provided their sheet anchor. So did their newfound Confederate identity. Life continued, and stubborn optimism managed to prevail. In fact, it did more than that. Amid the trials of war and privation, Richmonders had steadily continued their bold experiment in local Confederate government, Even in their waning days, they met to wrestle with the particulars of their common lives and their young country. The unpaid gas bills, the complaints about the Shaco Hill burial ground, the quarterly reports from the city measurer of wood. Debate was intense. Petty factionalisms and rivalries often intruded, but somehow faith persisted in their beleaguered way of life. Indeed, as late as April 1, the city council convened an urgent session to approve funds for the Richmond Soup Association and the Male Orphan Society. Yet unknown to them, by the next day, their way of life was to abruptly change. It wasn't apparent at first. The clouds of the evening were gone, and this morning, a hazy sky obscured the bursting of shells in the distance. A light breeze muffled their sound. And to the extent that Richmonders had heard guns before, they had been much nearer than today. This in itself meant nothing. By all apparent lights, it was a balmy day of Sabbath calm, with few absolute signs of the ominous portents to come. As they did every other Sunday, under a now blazing sun, thousands of Richmonders strolled to church. For some time now, the wooden pews and the minister's voices had been a favorite spot for many, a refuge from the sterner realities of the Civil War or a sturdy brace from which to confront the Confederacy's historic challenges. To the long-suffering Richmonders, their churches were a fortress of sacrifice and prayer. While they didn't intervene in Confederate politics, actually, they reinforced them, they did exert historic prerogatives as the nation waded into troubled waters and delivered a rousing message. With God's help, we will prevail. Whether with pageantry and pomp or simple hymns and psalms, theirs was a cool, consoling ritual in the eye of the storm. For their devout and dutiful communicants, the churches remained faithful custodians of the people's dreams. And if the pulpit were a place from which ministers inveighed against the enemy or exhorted the flock, such priestly activism was hardly unique in history. As was typically the case, the passion, the commitment, the words reflected those of the people themselves. The church of choice for Richmond's elite was St. Paul's Episcopal. Relatively new, built in 1845, today it was crowded with distinguished worshipers, mourning women, neatly attired in black, elderly men suited in gleaming blue, solemn government officials, and here and there assorted officers, resplendent in their Confederate uniforms. And of course, in pew number 63 was Confederate President Jefferson Davis, wearing a natty dark wool suit, a crisply pressed white shirt, and a traditional black tie. Not a pew was empty. The choir sang, "Jesus, Lover of My Soul," and the rector, Dr. Charles Minnegrode, his accented voice filled with robust timbre, intoned back, "The Lord is in His temple. Let all the earth keep silence before Him." Richmonders were sticklers for clerical tradition, and Minnegrode, the tiny German immigrant, soberly obliged them. With his thin lips, high forehead, and aquiline nose, he cut a striking figure in his formal regalia. Addressed as "Your Eminence" or "Your Excellency," the intensely pious Minnegrode was in his own way a legendary figure in Richmonders' affections. With them, he had weathered numerous crises before. Peering out with his Hessian eyes, folded hands, and bent head, he was unflappable in his priestly calm. This morning it would be needed. As shafts of dusky light filtered in through the large windows on the serene gray walls and stained oaken rosewood pews, he moved on to reading Zechariah chapter 2, verse 20. "The Lord is in His holy temple," he beseeched. "Let all the earth keep silence before Him." But it would have been just as appropriate if he had invoked Gethsemane, the garden to which Jesus withdrew in the evening before the crucifixion and the chilling code word for Christ's agony. That image, of course, is a grim one. Christ humiliated, Christ scourged, Christ bloodied and pricked by thorns. And by the time a military messenger eased through the door, it could well have been an apt metaphor for Richmond. Once Minnegrode's invocation was finished, the sexton hurried up to Davis and handed him a sealed envelope. Inside was an urgent telegram. Nearby congregants watched a sort of gray pallor creep over his face as he read the message from Lee, a moment forever frozen in the annals of the Confederacy. Then Davis rose and quickly walked down the aisle. A few staff members and couriers soon followed the president, but the bulk of the congregation remained in their seats. For these, the well-bred and well-to-do, manners forbade them from making an overt show of concern. So too with Minnegerode. But the circumstances threatened to betray even him, the reverend, who had always felt more comfortable in his native tongue, German, than in his adopted English, struggled to maintain his composure. His English steadily grew more frantic, but he nonetheless managed to finish the service. His eyes filled. Then he explained Davis's abrupt departure. Such attempts at serenity were not found at the rest of Richmond's churches. At the Second Presbyterian, Reverend Moses Hoag was in mid-sermon, when a messenger delivered him a note. "Brethren," Hoag said, looking up, "trying times are before us, but remember that God is with us in the storm as well as in calm." Then, in a voice trembling with emotion, he bid his flock a qualified farewell. "We may never meet again. Go quietly to our homes, and whatever may be in store for us, let us not forget that we are Christian men and women, and may the protection of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost be with you all." At this, the vast throng surged to its feet and quickly exited. Outside, stacks of government documents were piled up on the sidewalks by government offices. They were burning. The exodus had begun. Rumors flew. Word of the slow, bleak truth spread throughout the Seven Hills, and, by afternoon, most of Richmond knew that the city would have to be abandoned. Acceptance of the disaster began fitfully, accompanied by a sickening feeling of emptiness. Then came the initial panic. Railroad cars on the Danville line were hastily packed with boxes of official papers and more than $500,000 in gold and silver. Gold eagles, gold bars, gold bullion, gold nuggets and gold ingots, Mexican pesos, fine foreign currency, and gold plate and jewelry. While government officials tried to secure household goods and get reservations on the James River Canal packet boats for their families, it was generally assumed that the Confederate government had made adequate plans for evacuation. But events that afternoon told a different story. Church prayer services were canceled. For the next several hours, depositors stormed banks and soldiers lugged wheelbarrows of Confederate specie onto the lawns of Capitol Square to light one of many fires set during the day. An official evacuation announcement was finally made, around 4 p.m., and it was at that point that any remaining veneer of calm broke. Richmonders now fled. Excited families, hauling their personal wares, began to run toward railway stations seeking passage westward. Frightened columns of refugees set out along the canal towpath toward Lynchburg. Following behind, servants carried bundles to trains, and horses and their masters began plodding to all points west. As the city emptied, the streets were increasingly choked with humans, beasts, and all manner of wagons, carts, and rickety contraptions on wheels, anything to carry them to safety. From one road to the next, the pavement rumbled with the signs of incipient despair, and soon the gathering night shook with sounds of desperation, screaming, swearing, wailing, and the dreadful howls of animals being whipped, perhaps the most unearthly sound of all. Once dust dropped steadily over Richmond, for those unwilling or unable to flee, a different kind of night began. "Into every house," recalled one young woman, "terror penetrated. The more prosperous residents who stayed behind quietly retired inside their homes, lowering blinds and sealing shutters, anxiously waiting. Women, preparing for the worst, stitched valuables into small cloth sacks and strung them under their hoop skirts. Pistols were placed at the ready. People sat in paralyzed silence, loath even to speculate about what would happen next. The suspense was nearly unbearable, and it kept on hour after hour. For his part, a grim-faced but calm Jefferson Davis continued working in his office while his executive papers were packed up. Then, shortly before 5 p.m., he straightened his desk, not wanting the Federals to think him sloppy, and departed alone for the Confederate White House. His wife and children had already left the Capitol on a train bound for Charlotte, North Carolina. Around 7, after sending a favorite armchair to Mary Custis Lee with a note saying that he hoped it would ease her arthritis, Davis climbed into a carriage and headed for the railroad station, a freshly lit cigar clenched between his teeth. Hundreds were jamming the depot before Davis even arrived, and it was here, in the midst of the Confederate flight, that the Richmond slave trade came to its own ignominious end. A trader, with his coffle of 50 chained slaves, sought in vain to convince a soldier to allow him to board a crowded train. With a bayonet, the soldier barred him until the trader unlocked his $50,000 worth of property in the street and let them go. Davis, his cabinet, and other government officials were scheduled to depart at 8:30 p.m., crowded aboard a ramshackle train, each car poignantly labeled War Department, Quartermaster's Department, Treasury Department. But it was not until 11 that Davis at last bade farewell to Richmond as the train pulled away, jerking and clacking toward Danville, Virginia, the new capital of the CSA. The burden of government now fell to the city authorities. The mayor and a citizens' committee were authorized to meet the federal army and arrange a peaceful surrender. As the minutes ticked by, the city was laced with frustration and fear. Hard questions arose. What loomed largest in the minds of those remaining was, who among them would be made public targets of Yankee vengeance? There was talk of prison and the hangman's noose for treason. Many ardent secessionists, like Reverend Hogue, chose to flee. But at this moment, the city faced an even more immediate challenge, the near impossible task of maintaining order. After nightfall, the military and the militia prepared to carry out their instructions. Destroy all weaponry. Torch all commodities, including the vast tobacco warehouses. Get rid of all liquor. As the evening faded, they complied. A few artillerists dumped cannon into the James to join the handful of Confederate naval vessels being scuttled. It was the liquor, however, that went first, with unforeseen but dismal consequences. Around midnight, at the well-intentioned order of the city council, the militia turned to Richmond's stores of whiskey, bashing in some 300 barrel heads and pouring thousands of gallons into the gutters. It was a grave mistake. Shifty looters quickly followed, scooping up what they could from the streets and even lapping up the remnants like animals prowling along the curbs. Enlivened by the spirits, the melee began in full force. Prisoners, who had escaped from abandoned jails, began sacking everything in sight. Food stores, jewelry stores, dry goods shops, warehouses, abandoned townhomes. Elsewhere, the dispossessed left their dank saloons, whorehouses, and dilapidated tenements to join in the free-for-all, looting, fighting one another, even helping themselves to what remained of food for the army. Soon, a swelling mob, first in the tens, then in the hundreds, then in the thousands, ruled the night. In the words of one resident, it was the saddest of many of the sad sights of the war, a city undergoing pillage at the hand of its own mob, while the standards of an empire were being taken from the capital. Said another, dismay reigned supreme. Now there were no guards, no policemen, nothing to stop the wholesale destruction. The rule of law was abandoned. That night, one citizen explained, the devil was loosed. But not everywhere. In the dark, the city's gas lines had been shut off. A few residents simply straggled to the sidewalks to watch as the last of their military defenders, the proud Army of Northern Virginia, swung southward over the James. They reassured themselves that the fight was anything but over. Lee would still carry on. Yet even this comforting interlude was short-lived. Under a pale descending moon, a new terror now struck. Fire. The second series of orders were to destroy the tobacco warehouses. In the depths of night, it was done. The initial flames began innocuously, with thin wisps of bluish smoke curling upward from the doomed windows of these embattled buildings. But then, they quickly raced through the dry, fragrant leaves and began to scale the walls and roof. From that moment on, no one knew exactly how the fires spread. Soon, however, entire buildings were ablaze. Then, a stiff southerly breeze began to blow. The flames widened and lengthened and finally began to leap from one building onto the next. On many streets, the lights from the fires were now bright enough to read one's newspaper or Bible. The closer the flames came, the bigger they began to grow. Nor was this simply illusion. Like a funeral pyre, the blaze rolled up from the waterfront, hissing and sparking and crackling. The old colonial timber undergirding much of Richmond didn't help. It made the fire insatiable for more. Suddenly, in building after building, plaster dust came down. This was soon followed by a series of thunderous crashes as charred beams buckled and split. Walls began to break. The air was abruptly filled with flying brick and broken glass. And then came the ear-splitting sounds of whole structures collapsing into rubble, crushed like paper bags. People began to wonder if they would be buried alive, or burned, or if their corpses would be recovered. And they were now running, stumbling, and crawling, dragging what few belongings they could out on the street. One